the body that betrayed by 2003, Steve Jobs was on top of the world. Apple had bounced back. The iPod was changing how people endured music. And for Formally, everything sounded aligned. Also came the pain in his side, a small, nearly sightable pang that would rewrite the final chapter of his life. Croker set up a rare form of pancreatic cancer. The news hit him with quiet desolation. For a man who'd always bent the world to his will, then was commodity he could end control. At first, Jobs refused conventional treatment. He turned rather to diets, acupuncture, and spiritual mending. Musketeers prayed him to review, but he was stubborn. He believed suspicion could heal what wisdom could end. 9 months passed. The excrescence didn't shrink. It grew. By the time he agreed to surgery, the cancer had formally spread. It was his biggest mistake, and he knew it. Latterly, he admitted to musketeers that he rued the detention. The man who'd erected his conglomerate on trusting his gut had eventually learned that instinct has limits. But he didn't dwell on remorse. He concentrated on time, how to use what remained. Mortality as provocation utmost people, when faced with death, decelerate down. Jobs did the contrary. He dove deeper into his work. Every product, every meeting, every discussion took on new urgency. Mortality stoned his focus like no way ahead. He frequently repeated a line from a Whole Earth roster, a counterculture magazine he loved in his youth, "Stay empty, stay foolish." It was an mantra presently, it was survival. He told a platoon, "If moment were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do?" It was ant rhetorical. It was a sludge for meaning. Those who worked with him during those times describe a man both softer and further violent. He came more open with emotion, more tender with his family, yet more ruthless with his work. He didn't want sympathy. He wanted heritage. The iPhone gamble by 2005. Apple had reinvented music and design. But Jobs wasn't satisfied. He saw what mobile phones were getting. Cumbrous bias with terrible software, and knew Apple could do better. Inside the company, he gathered a small platoon in secret and told them, "We're going to make a phone, but it has to be insanely great." The platoon allowed. He was out of his mind. The idea of combining a phone, iPod, and internet profit in one satiny device sounded insolvable. Yet he pushed harder than ever. His health was fragile. He was thinner now, his energy changeable. But when he was in a design review, it was like watching electricity move through him. Johnny, I've latterly said, he'd walk into the room and you'd forget he was sick. He'd see a wind on the screen that was ent perfect and stop everything until it was right. In January 2007, Jobs walked onto the stage at Macworld, wearing his usual black turtleneck and jeans. He looked a little haggard, but still carried that spark. He smiled and said, "Moment, Apple is going to resuscitate the phone." And he did. The iPhone wasn't just a product, it was an event. It changed communication, culture, indeed posture. The world suddenly lived in its hands. No Bone realized it at the time, but that keynote would come on his last great public triumphs. A fragile king after the iPhone success, Jobs' health began to deteriorate again. He lost weight dramatically, his skin grew pale, and his energy changed. Apple, being Apple, kept effects private, but rumors swirled. Prints of a visibly frail Jobs surfaced, and the media suspected endlessly. He abominated that attention. He wanted people to see the work, not the weakness. In 2009, he passed a liver transplant. The surgery bought him further time, but drained him physically. Still, he worked through recovery. Indeed, from a sanitarium bed, he reviewed designs, transferred emails, and called meetings. His associates described it as both inspiring and heartbreaking, this man who refused to step back, driven not by pride, but by a profound fear of leaving his charge untreated. He told Tim Cook, "I no way want you to ask what I would do. Just do what's right." It was both an instruction and a warning. He knew his time was running short. He wanted to leave clarity behind. Fatherhood and farewell Jobs' family life had always been complicated. For times, he'd been distant, consumed by work. But as illness braked him down, he began to see what really signified. He spent further time with his woman, Lorene, and their three children. He reconnected emotionally with Lisa, his son from his earlier relationship with Chris and Brennan. Lisa latterly wrote about those final times in her bio, Small Shindig, describing a father who could be both cruelly honest and deeply loving. He'd oscillate between review and tender-heartedness, frequently within the same discussion. One evening, while walking in their theater, he told Loreen, "I used to suppose a big opinion signified most. Turns out, it's the small bones, how you treat people, what you say before you leave the room." That's what the complaint had tutored immortality, clarifies love. He started giving small gifts, music recommendations, handwritten notes, books that meant commodity to him, to each of his children. He left a piece of his curiosity. For someone who'd erected machines meant to outlast him, he eventually understood that heritage was lower about bias and further about connection. The final systems, indeed, as his body weakened, Jobs remained hung up with the future. He tete-a-tete oversaw the early designs for the iPad, believing it would be the purest expression of Apple's vision, a window into digital creation without the clutter of a keyboard or mouse. The iPad launched in 2010, and though critics called it gratuitous at first, it vended millions. Jobs called it magical. For formally, the word didn't feel like marketing. It felt particular. He also poured energy into commodity. Many knew about the new Apple lot. He wanted it to be a physical personification of his design principles. Indirect, open, natural. A place where masterminds and artists could unite freely. Apple Park, completed times after his death, is maybe his most lyrical creation. It's not a product, it's a space for creation itself. In his final months, Jobs was frequently seen walking sluggishly around his home, sketching ideas, reviewing mock-ups, or just gaping at trees. When asked what he was allowing, he said, "I'm still connecting the blotches." The meaning of time then's a thing. Jobs no way accepted the idea of enough. Indeed, when dying, he wanted further time, not for luxury, but for work, he told Walter Isaacson, who was writing his memoir, "I suppose about death a lot, because it's the single stylish invention of life. It clears out the old to make way for the new." He said it calmly, like he'd made peace with it, but his eyes betrayed a different story. Sadness, perhaps sweat, but also gratefulness. He knew he'd been lucky to find what he loved, to make commodity lasting, to love deeply. Utmost people no way get indeed one of those. And that consummation, further than any keynote or invention, was his final act of brilliance. He'd spent his life tutoring people to conjure bigger. In the end, he tutored them to see beauty in limitation. A quiet, resolved bimid. 2011, Jobs could no longer hide his illness. His frame was cadaverous. His voice softer, but his mind was still sharp. He stepped down as Apple CEO on August 24, 2011, naming Tim Cook as a successor. The letter he wrote to Apple's board was short, precise, nearly stoic. "I've always said that if there ever came a day when I can no longer meet my duties and prospects as Apple's CEO, I will be the first to let you know. Unfortunately, that day has come." He inked it simply, "Steve." No drama, no sentiment. Just clarity. But those who knew him said he cried that day, not because he was hysterical, but because it was over. The work that had defined him, the company that had come as reflection, the trip that began in a garage now handed to someone differently. The end of the morning in his final weeks, Jobs spent utmost of his time at home in Palo Alto, girdled by family. He still took meetings sometimes, occasionally from his bed, occasionally in the theater. Musketeers who visited said he was reflective, frequently philosophical. He'd talk about the patterns of life, the meter of nature, how everything connects. He formally told his family, Mona, "It's strange to suppose that eventually I'll just be dust, but the work, perhaps that's the way we live on." On October 5, 2011, Steve Jobs passed away peacefully, girdled by Loreen and his children. He was 56. Outside Apple stores around the world, people left flowers, notes, and half-stunk apples with candles outside. The world had lost its utopian. But his echo remained in every fund, on every office, in every person who dared to suppose different. Steve Jobs, Episode 6, Part 2, Approximate. 2,000 words. The echo after silence when Steve Jobs failed on October 5, 2011, the world stopped for a moment. Outside Apple stores from San Francisco to Shanghai, people erected sanctuaries out of flowers, apples, and handwritten notes. Some drew the stunk Apple totem with a halo. Others left iPhones and iPods playing soft music at night. It was strange, mourning not just a person, but an idea. The news spread briskly than any caption before it. Twitter crashed for twinkles under the swell of posts. Journals across the world led with a single name, Steve Jobs, 1955-2011. For a man who no way wanted fame for its own sake, the outpour would have made him uncomfortable. Yet, deep down, he might have smiled. He always said he wanted to make a dent in the macrocosm. Now it was clear he had. The day after inside Apple's headquarters, the silence was heavy. Workers stood in the yard, numerous crying openly. Tim Cook, now CEO, gathered everyone and spoke still. Steve erected this company to last beyond him, and it will. That day, the Apple homepage went black and white, a single print of Jobs, eyes concentrated, half smiling. Below it, his birth and death times. No tagline, no watchword. Just him. It was the utmost Apple homage possible, minimum important mortal. Cook and the leadership platoon had one job, now keep Apple alive, without the man who was Apple. They knew what the world anticipated. The coming product launch, the coming keynote, the coming device, all of it would be judged against a ghost. But Cook also knew commodity differently. Jobs had wanted to be canonized. He'd wanted to be continued. The legacy machine in the months that followed. People tried to understand what Jobs really left before. Some refocus of the iPhone, the iPad, the Mac. Others said his topmost creation was Apple itself, a living, breathing organism erected on his values. Jobs had designed not just products but a system, a culture where design and engineering worked as one, where every detail signified, where good enough was no way good enough. His notorious expression, real artist boat, came the unofficial aphorism of the company. Every time Apple released a new product, people would ask, would Steve have approved? But the better question was, did Steve design the system so others could decide? And he had. That was his final act of genius. He didn't leave before instructions. He left behind a mindset. The memoir that defined him a many weeks after his death, Walter Isaacson's authorized memoir, Steve Jobs, hit bookstores worldwide. Jobs had given Isaacson complete access. Musketeers, family, indeed old adversaries. He told him, be honest, do and color it. I want the verity. The book painted him as both visionary and dictator. It revealed the contradictions that made him who he was. Spiritual yet ruthless, minimalist yet compulsive, private yet glamorous. Compendiums devoured it. Some were inspired. Others were unsettled. The portrayal was raw, and that's how Jobs wanted it. He understood commodity, most legends do imperfection, is incredible. Truth is, he formally said, being the richest man in the cemetery doesn't matter to me. Going to bed at night, saying we've done commodity awful, that's what matters. That line came the emotional heart of the book, and perhaps of his life. The Apple without Steve Tim Cook's first many times as CEO were about proving stability. He was then a showman, and he didn't try to be. His keynotes were quieter, his tone measured. At first, suckers and investors misdoubted him. They missed Jobs' seductiveness. The one further thing moments, the flashes of changeable brilliance. But Cook played a longer game. He concentrated on refinement, expansion, and ethics. Under him, Apple didn't just grow it converted. The company doubled its profit, entered new requests, and came the first to hit $1 trillion valuation. Products like the Apple Watch and AirPods carried the same design DNA Jobs had established. Cook also turned Apple into a leader in sustainability and sequestration, areas Jobs had watched about but no way prioritized intimately. Sluggishly, the world realized Apple hadn't lost its soul. It had evolved. Jobs erected a rocket. Cook made sure it stayed en route. The myth and the man after his death. Steve Jobs came further than mortal. He came myth. People started invoking his name in meetings and pictures, quoting him in motivational speeches, comparing every new CEO or inventor to him. The coming Steve Jobs came both a compliment and a curse. But what utmost people missed was that Jobs no way wanted votaries. He wanted originals. He respected rebellion, not replication. As he formerly said, "Don't be trapped by dogma," which is living with the results of other people's thinking. The irony is, that's exactly what happened. Entire diligence tried to copy him, his operation style, his donations, his black turtleneck livery, without understanding the spirit beneath it authenticity. Jobs was in trying to be different for its own sake. He was being himself valorously. That's what made him irreplaceable. The global mourning in the months after his death. Paeans poured in from leaders, artists, and challengers. Bill Gates, his longtime rival and complicated friend, wrote, "For those of us lucky enough to work with him, it's been an insanely great honor." Barack Obama said, "Steve was among the topmost of American originators, stalwart enough to suppose else, bold enough to believe he could change the world." Mark Zuckerberg posted, "Thanks for showing that what you make can change the world. I'll miss you." But the most touching homage came from Apple's own staff. Each wrote a short communication that began with, "Dear Steve." Thousands of them filled a massive digital wall. Thank, use, pledges, delineations, indeed admissions. Some said, "You made me believe in beauty." Others wrote, "You tutor me to watch about my work." It was a collaborative letter from humanity to one man who'd helped define the ultra-modern spirit of creation. The family he left behind for Lorene Powell Jobs. Life after Steve was quiet but purposeful. She took the fortune he left and erected commodity deeply aligned with his ideals, the Emerson Collaborative, an association concentrated on education, immigration reform, and environmental progress. Lorene said in an interview, "Steve's heritage is ain't just Apple. It's in how people suppose. I see it in classrooms, in entrepreneurs, in artists. He changed the birth of imagination." Their son, Reed, pursued medical exploration. Their daughters, Erin and Eve, follow creative and entrepreneurial paths. Lisa Brennan Jobs, from his early relationship, published Small Fry, a bio that painted a more complex, mortal picture of father, brilliant, effective, but trying to love. Through them, his particular side lived on the part of him that no way made it into product launches or press prints. The ghost in the machine indeed times after his death. People still feel Steve Jobs in every Apple keynote. When the lights shroud and the music swells, the expectation, the meter, the showmanship, it's all his. His fingerprints remain on the company's DNA. Inside Apple, contrivers still use expressions he chased, "do ent boat crap." We're then to make a dent. Simple can be harder than complex. He's gone, but his mindset is ignited into the system. Every decision still echoes the question, what would make Steve smile? That unnoticeable presence keeps the company honest. It's both a gift and a weight, a memorial that heritage is both alleviation and pressure. But perhaps that's how he wanted it. He didn't want comfort. He wanted pressure, the kind that drives creation. The world he prognosticated still, he'd presumably beam if Jobs could see 2025. Phones have replaced hold dolls. Buses are computers on bus. The internet fits in a brace of spectacles. Artificial intelligence writes, paints, and composes. He prognosticated all of it, not in exact terms, but in spirit. He always said, "The biggest inventions are unnoticeable until they're ineluctable." That's why his influence feels endless. Every time a product tries to be magical, every time a company talks about experience rather than features, you're hearing his echo. Indeed, companies that formerly mocked him now chase his playbook: empathy, design, simplicity, liar. The world didn't just borrow his tools. It absorbed his thinking. The gospel that remains at the center of Jobs' life was a single belief: technology should serve the mortal spirit. That's what made his vision dateless. He didn't worship the machine. He used it to celebrate humanity. When he unveiled the iPad, he said, "It's the most intimate thing we've ever made." Utmost people allowed, he meant the touchscreen. He meant connection, the way a piece of glass could bridge art, curiosity, and creation. In a sense, that was always his charge to humanize technology. That charge did and die with him. It's the quiet turnabout of every invention since. The quiet impact then's what people infrequently talk about. Jobs didn't just inspire leaders. He changed workers. Contrivers started fighting for simplicity. Masterminds started minding about aesthetics. Marketers started telling stories. not dealing features. He blurred the lines between art and business until the two were thick. Indeed moment. A youthful inventor nearly is obsessing over the wind of a button or the sense of scroll, because Jobs made that preoccupation meaningful. That's how influence works. It doesn't fade. It composites. The symbol of the bite, let's talk about that stunk apple totem. People assume it represents the interdicted fruit of knowledge. Others say it's a nod to Alan Turing, the father of computing, who failed after smelling into a poisoned apple. Jobs no way verified any of it. He just said it looked good. But perhaps that's the point. The totem, like Jobs himself, means what you bring to it. It's riddle as design. A memorial that great ideas don't need to explain themselves. They need to feel right. That's what he left us with, a sense of wonder and simplicity. The immortal vision time has a way of softening legends, but Steve Jobs isn't faded. However, his presence has only grown sharper, if anything. Further than a decade after his death, you still hear his voice in boardrooms, classrooms, design workrooms. Incipiency garages the mantra, a supposed different echoing like a prayer. Not because people miss the man, but because they miss the clarity. Jobs had this rare, nearly uncomfortable capability to cut through noise. He could walk into a room full of opinions and say, "No, this is it." And he'd be right. That kind of certainty is what people crave. It's also what they sweat. He was ent right because he was a prophet. He was right because he understood mortal jest better than utmost psychologists. He knew what people wanted before they did, because he wanted the same effects: beauty, simplicity, meaning. The heritage of taste ends the thing Jobs' topmost product was end the iPhone or the Mac or Pixar. It was taste. He elevated taste to a competitive advantage. He made people watch about how effects feel, not just how they work. Before him, design was decoration. After him, design was gospel. He used to say, "Design isn't just what it looks like and feels like. Design is how it works." That judgment changed diligence. It's why your auto dashboard looks clean, why your apps are intuitive, why your watch face is elegant. He tutored the world that technology should feel mortal. In a strange way, that's the eternity he was after. Not statues, not fame, but influence that would still shape the everyday. The ripple effect, let's break it down. Jobs' way of thinking didn't just impact tech. It bled into armature, education, film, retail, indeed healthcare. In armature, Apple's design language, clean lines, natural light, unnoticeable joins, reshape how companies erected their services. The Apple Park Lot, completed after his death, is a perfect illustration of indirect spaceship girdle by nature, erected not to impress investors, but to inspire workers. In education, seminaries worldwide started tutoring design thinking, creativity, and liar, ideas Jobs live by but no way homogenized. In film, Pixar's liar DNA, erected under his power, came the standard of emotional verity and vitality. In retail, the Apple Store changed the entire conception of consumer experience. No pushy salesman, no clutter, just space and curiosity. Now every brand tries to copy that energy. And in healthcare, believe it or not, his asseveration on stoner-friendly tech led to the interfaces that power ultra-modern medical bias. It's like he rewired how the world thinks about tools. His greatest paradox, Jobs' life is filled with contradictions. He sermonized simplicity, but was complicated. He wanted control, but sought enlightenment. He could be both cruel and compassionate in the same hour. But that's what made him real. He didn't try to resolve his contradictions. He used them. He'd meditate one morning and scream at a developer that autumn. He'd gormandize for clarity and also spend millions on perfection. He lived at the edge of axes, and that pressure fueled his creativity. When people call him a genius, that's what they're really pointing to: the capability to live with opposing trueness and still move forward. He was balanced. He was aligned. The untreated story still, he'd be 70 if Jobs were alive moment. It's tempting to imagine what he'd suppose of the world. Would he love the idea of AI designing art, or would he see it as soulless bloomin'? Would he laugh at folding phones, or resuscitate them from scrape? He'd presumably still be chasing commodity insane, perhaps particular robotics, orbio design, or spiritual computing. He formally said, We're just at the morning of understanding what technology can do for the mortal mind. That statement feels predictive now. In a world drowning in data, Jobs' gospel, focus, clarity, fineness, feels more critical than ever. We don't just miss his products. We miss his point of view. The spiritual thread people frequently forget how spiritual Jobs really was. His times in India shaped him profoundly. He wasn't religious in a formal sense, but he believed in suspicion, in unseen connections. He talked about connecting the blotches only when looking backward, a reflection of error in a way. When he spoke about death, he did it with disarming calm. In his 2005 Stanford speech, he said, "Flashing back that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life." That was not just rhetoric. It was how he lived. He cut out anything that didn't matter, stripped life to its rudiments, and chased what he called the lightness of being. It's lyrical that someone who made machines spend his life trying to elevate the mortal spirit. The mortal behind the icon beneath the legend, there was a man who loved penmanship, who cried during music performances, who sat in silence for hours just to feel an idea. He wasn't always kind. He wasn't always fair. But he was always present. That's what people who work with him flash back most. When he looked at you, it was like sun, violent, unblinking, searching. He wanted to see if you believe what you were saying. And if you didn't, he'd tear you piecemeal. But if you did, if your idea reverberated, he'd cover it with everything he had. He formally told Johnny Ive, "The most important thing is to believe you're doing commodity wonderful. However, why bother if you do and feel that?" That's the emotional core of his story. He was an erecting widgets. He was erecting wonder. The shadow of greatness then's what history tends to buff over greatness cost commodity. Jobs' perfectionism came with contributory damage. Burned out brigades, broken gemütlichkeit, hurt passions. He formally said to a co-worker, "This is who I am." UCA and anticipate Picasso not to get makeup on the bottom. He knew his intensity hurt people, but he couldn't be anyone differently. After he failed, some of those who disaccorded with him admitted commodity strange. They missed the fire. They realized his harshness was an atrocity. It was a demand for excellence. He believed in them more fiercely than they believed in themselves. It's easy to call that poisonous now, but for numerous, it was transformative. That's the complicated verity about Jobs. He made people more. Indeed, if it hurt. The universe he downsized, let's talk about that, dent in the macrocosm line. It's been quoted so frequently it's virtually cliché, but many people know the environment. Jobs said it in a meeting in 1984, when Apple was still small. Someone argued that what they were doing didn't matter in the grand scheme. Jobs slammed the table and said, "We're then to make a dent in the macrocosm. Else, why indeed bother being then?" He meant it. That judgment came the gravitational center of his life. Everything he did, every fight, every product, every threat was an attempt to count. And the thing is, he did. The macrocosm didn't just dent. It bent around him. The durability when you look at moment originators, Elon Musk, Tim Cook, Jeff Bezos. Satya Nadella, you see fractions of Jobs' DNA. Musk channels his boldness. Cook carries his discipline. Bezos borrows his preoccupation with guests. Nadella reflects his mortal, centered vision. But no bone completely replicates him. Because Jobs was in a formula. He was an emotion of contradictions. Artist and mastermind. Monk and Napoleon. Utopian and doer. That's why his story still resonates. It's not just about invention. It's about integrity of vision. He proved that technology could be soulful. That ambition could be lyrical. And that's what keeps his story alive. The final reflection Jobs' last words, according to his family, were simple, "Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow." No bone knows exactly what he saw or felt, but it's fitting. His life was one long "oh, wow," a nonstop pursuit of admiration. He didn't just want to make products that worked. He wanted to make moments that made people stop and feel commodity. That's what makes his heritage dateless. Because at the end of all the law, all the glass, all the circuits, what Jobs really erected was emotion. He erected a ground between sense and love. And that ground is still standing. The ending allowed still, perhaps he'd tell us one last thing. if Steve Jobs were then moment. Commodity like technology is just the oil, what you paint on it. That's the art, and that's the assignment he left before do and chase perfection, chase meaning. Do and copy what exists. Imagine what could. Stay curious. Stay empty. Stay foolish.